AP 803, Milton J. Christensen versus Michael J. Sullivan. Arguing on behalf of Milwaukee County and David Clark, the Milwaukee County Sheriff, is Andrew Jones of White Hirschbeck. He will argue for 25 minutes. Patrick Patterson, representing Milton Christensen and others, 30 minutes. And then Mr. Jones has 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Andrew Jones, and I represent...
That mic, right?
You want to get it closer and higher so we can hear you.
Okay.
So if you want us to hear you, right there.
Either speak up or...
Yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Again, I represent the defendants, respondents, petitioners in this case, Milwaukee County, in the office of the Milwaukee County Sheriff. In my short time before you today, I'd like to emphasize four distinct reasons why the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case should be reversed. First, because the decision conflicts with the plain, unambiguous language of Wisconsin's contempt statute, Chapter 785. Second, because the decision expands this court's recent holding in Frisch v. Henricks in ways that the Frisch majority certainly did not intend. Third, because it is inconsistent with the purposes and the legislative history of the contempt statute. And finally, even if it is otherwise correct, the Court of Appeals decision improperly removed any discretion from the trial court in selecting a remedial contempt sanction on remand. This proceeding, this contempt proceeding, arises from the fact that between November 2001 and May 2004, Milwaukee County did not move every prisoner through the booking room of the Milwaukee County Jail fast enough to comply with the consent decree that had been entered by the court.
What did the contempt decree demand?
The consent decree, 40-plus pages of it, required any number of things.
I know, but what's at issue in this case?
The specific provision that's at issue in this case is what the parties, at least, have come to call the 30-hour rule.
Okay.
And specifically that provision, which I believe is found in Part 1, Sections 2C and D of the consent decree, required that the county move prisoners that were booked into the jail through what is known as the booking room. It's the first place you go to when you're booked into the jail, through that booking room and into a housing area of the jail in under 30 hours. Overall, so that's the particular provision that the county did not live up to in that time period between November 2001 and May of 2004. Overall, as I said, the consent decree deals with very significant fundamental issues of system change within the jail. And overall,
but do you concede that you didn't, that Milwaukee County Jail did not live up to the 30-hour rule?
The county acknowledged before the trial court that there were a significant number of prisoners that, in fact, did not leave the booking room in under 30 hours, and the county certainly acknowledges that again before this court.
16,600 and something or other?
The precise number was never litigated. It did not become a finding of fact of the court. It was simply acknowledged and agreed by the parties that there were, in fact, a significant number of prisoners that fell outside or that did not meet the 30-hour rule.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals indicates in paragraph 8 that, in essence, the issue of contempt is no longer an issue in this case. It says Milwaukee does not appeal the finding that it was in contempt of the trial court's order approving the consent decree based on the violations, et cetera. My question is that correct, that you are acknowledging that you did not appeal the contempt finding and that is not in issue today?
That is correct.
So you accept that it's contempt. The issue is what are the remedies or damages, if any, when you are in contempt?
That is absolutely correct.
Okay.
The specific issue is under Chapter 785, whether – whether compensatory damages are available as a remedial contempt sanction when, in fact, the underlying conduct, the conduct that formed the basis of the contempt finding, is over, has stopped. And that's a critical fact in this case, because although the county acknowledged that there were a significant number of prisoners that did not pass through the booking room fast enough, it is an absolute fact, it is undisputed, that the violations of the 30-hour rule ended long before the plaintiff class here ever filed a motion seeking a
My understanding that everybody agreed it ended in about May 2004, and that this action for compensation came after May 2004, in September of 2004.
That is correct.
Okay.
And there is no dispute between the parties that there has never been a violation of the 30-hour rule since May 2004. The jail books approximately 50,000 inmates into the jail every year.
And in the Not at one time.
Not at one time. Although I'm sure to the people in the booking room, it seems as though they're getting 50,000 at one time. 4.5 years have passed since the last 30-hour rule violation.
Is there any explanation on the record as to why, as soon as the request was made to investigate whether the consent decree was being followed, almost immediately thereafter, the violation stopped? How could that happen?
Well, the explanation is, quite simply, that the county was not aware that this many people were being held in the booking room for too long. Of course, yes, how could they not know 16,000
exactly.
people?
Exactly.
But in the context of a booking room that sees 50,000 people a year, and in the context of a consent decree that had multiple population control provisions and multiple requirements dealing with entirely different subjects, such as medical care in the jail, the focus in the jail was on complying with the overall population cap. There was a cap of 1,100 on the total population of the jail. And the testimony of the command staff that is in the record is that their day by day, their overriding focus was on ensuring that they were able to keep within that 1,100 cap. And their belief was that by doing so, the other provisions, including the 30-hour rule, would follow and that they would be able to comply with that rule. If we can keep the number of people in the jail within the set limit, we will be able to move people through the booking room fast enough.
The other thing we should settle, it seems to me, and especially in light of your comments, is my understanding is that the trial court found that your violations were intentional. Right?
As a matter of law, the court found that those violations were intentional.
And you're not disputing that finding?
That is not central to our appeal, no.
Okay. I just want to settle these issues so we get to what is central to your appeal.
To finish answering your question,
sorry,
Justice Crooks, when the issues were raised, however, about, well, in fact, are we getting people through the booking room fast enough? And when they were able to dig deep enough to understand whether or not this was in fact happening, it obviously became clear to them that it wasn't, and in big numbers that it had not been happening. What the realization was is that even though they were keeping within the 1,100 cap, the way that they classify inmates in the jail for various housing pods prevented them from using all of the beds in the facility. They use an objective classification system. It's a modern correction tool, which means you don't house women with men. You don't house certain offenders with certain objective characteristics, the type of crime, criminal history, with those far lesser crimes, far lesser criminal history. The result of that is they couldn't use every bed in the facility. The result of that was there a backlog. They didn't realize this was happening. When they realized it was happening, obviously they saw it as a problem. They took the steps to correct it. And they did that by unilaterally lowering the 1,100 population cap to 960. The county took it on itself to do that. And the result of that is that it freed up beds. They could move prisoners through the booking room.
Was that being done by using places like the House of Corrections, or what were they doing?
Well, all along, the county has used multiple tools to try and stay within the population cap. But the immediate fix in April and May of 2004 was, yes, to find additional housing elsewhere, including the House of Corrections, so that they could keep within the cap and move people through the booking room fast enough.
Council, what, if any, impact do you think it has that the initial complaint never asked for money damages?
Well, I think it's certainly it was critical on the second issue that was before the Court of Appeals, and that had to do with the plaintiff's breach of contract theory. The idea being that this is a case where they never asked for money damages. It's a case where the class was not certified for money damages. It's a case where, in fact, before the trial court, at the time when the decree was being discussed to be entered as an order of the court, they essentially disavowed any intent or request for money damages. And then after the fact, sort of changing the rules in the middle of the game, it became about money damages. And that, I think, was central to Judge Fiorenda's finding in terms of the breach of contract argument.
But she also found you couldn't get a compensatory damages under remedial contempt.
Correct. It was an issue for the breach of contract because it had never been asked for. But in terms of remedial contempt, yes, because the conduct was over, the statute, its plain language, doesn't permit remedial contempt sanctions.
The issue before us is whether you can get compensatory damages for remedial contempt under the facts of this case. Is that
correct?
Right?
Isn't there also an issue, Counselor, that this class was never certified for damages, so there was no ability to opt out as there would have been had it been so certified?
If this case returns to the trial court with the Court of Appeals ruling intact, I believe that is absolutely a critical question that the trial court is going to have to answer, and that's a hurdle that the parties are going to have to get past. Because this is a class for injunctive relief, and the standards are quite different, as you point out. And this jumps to the last point that I wanted to make before this court, is that the effect of the Court of Appeals ruling as it stands is that the trial court has been directed to provide compensatory damages as a remedial sanction for members of the class. But properly, the trial court should have discretion as to which, if any, of the available remedial contempt sanctions should be imposed. And I think in considering that question, the trial court is going to have to tackle that hurdle, whether this class should be and can be certified as a class for monetary relief.
Right. Counsel, I want to return to Justice Ziegler's question. And as I recall it, it was essentially of what moment is it that they never asked for money damages. You responded right away going to what I refer in my mind as the second issue, the contract damages issue. Does the fact that they never asked for money damages enter into the analysis of the contempt issue?
I think on the face of Chapter 785, it's not a determinative issue. But I do think if certainly the question has been raised by the plaintiff class in their briefs before this court and the Court of Appeals, well, you're essentially arguing that we don't have a remedy here, or that we can't get relief for what occurred to us. And I think in that context, it is entirely relevant to consider the fact that in bringing this lawsuit over conditions in the jail, this same plaintiff class did not ask for monetary relief.
Let me just refine that in my own mind. In other cases, normally, it would be of little consequence if I were making a finding of contempt and holding someone in contempt, whether or not in their underlying action they ever asked for money damages isn't dispositive generally. Would you agree with me or not agree with me? I'm not trying to cabin you. I'm just trying to find out really where, if at all, does that issue fit in your argument here today on the contempt issue as opposed to the other issue?
Well, I think, I think Chapter 785, if you're wondering whether you can give a remedial contempt sanction, you go to 785.01 sub 3 and you ask, well, is there a continuing contempt of court that can be terminated by issuing a contempt sanction? And that doesn't necessarily get to the question of, well,
what did they plead?
What was the relief in the request in the original complaint?
That's exactly what I'm thinking of, too, and I don't think you disagree with me with that generally anyway.
But I do think that in considering, are these plaintiffs without a remedy here, or have they been denied a remedy? I think it is relevant to consider what they asked for, and in fact, they have achieved what they originally asked for in the lawsuit by seeking injunctive relief. And two, I think it's also perhaps relevant for the trial court to consider in exercising its discretion over which, if any, remedial sanction to impose among those that might be available.
Counsel, if they do not receive compensatory damages for remedial contempt, what other avenues for relief or compensation are there for them?
Well, I'm perhaps not the best person to ask because I represent the county and not the plaintiff class. I'm perhaps not the best person to speak about
that. But
you
are the best person to ask because you're standing there. So please, go ahead.
I think the critical point is that the plaintiffs have never argued, and this is in the context of the Frisch v. Hendricks decision, the plaintiffs here have never argued that there are not other remedies available to them. And in fact, the Court of Appeals observed that perhaps there are other remedies available, such as under Section 1983, or another cause of action that relates to conditions of confinement. Those are not new claims to the court. And one of the amicus parties, one of the friends of the court, the brief submitted by Professor Martineau, et cetera, pointed out that, in fact, remedies such as Section 1983 or perhaps a claim under the Wisconsin Constitution might be available to the plaintiffs.
Mr. Jones, is there another issue here that we really haven't talked about at length? And that's the argument that there is allegedly a breach of the consent decree, that's the same as a breach of contract, and that therefore there could be compensatory damages for breach of contract. Now, it's my understanding that the Court of Appeals never got to that issue. Is that right?
That is correct. The Court of Appeals never addressed that argument.
If we thought that was an argument that ought to be addressed, would that realistically be remanded to the Court of Appeals?
I think this court obviously has that option. That's certainly one option.
The other option is for us to decide it, right?
Yes. And it certainly was briefed before the trial court. It was raised by the plaintiffs in their brief and responded at least briefly to in our reply brief, given the constraints of the reply brief.
Let's get to the main event, for me anyway.
Yes.
785.01 says remedial sanction means a sanction imposed for the purpose of terminating a continuing contempt of court, right?
Correct.
And in the Frisch case, the court had a little trouble dealing with whether there was a continuing contempt. In that case, it was a family law case. The court had ordered the husband to give financial documents annually or thereabouts so that they could calculate child support, as I remember the case. And year went in, year went out, and he didn't do it. Finally, he came forth, but there was a little problem because for all those years, child support had not been appropriately determined on the financial reports. But now his contempt seemed to be over. He had handed over the documents. But the court said,
Well, you have, he's been a bad guy for all these years. He's violated the court order. He's in contempt. There's no way of dealing with this other than to recognize that there are compensatory damages, even though some might argue that the contempt was not continuing, right?
Correct.
And in effect, that's part of your argument here. The contempt was over because in May 2004, they obeyed the court order, right?
That is absolutely part
right.
of our argument.
My problem is this, and it reminds me because you mentioned the Martineau et others and others brief. 785.04.1 says, a remedial sanction, which is imposed for the purpose of terminating continued contempt, I'm just reading the definition, can be payment of a sum of money sufficient to compensate a party for a loss or injury suffered, past tense, by the party as a result of the contempt of court. Now, the plain language of this statute, right on its face, says, hey, you suffered as a result of a contempt of court, you should be compensated. And Martineau and the others, and Martineau was the reporter that drafted Chapter 785 that the legislature adopted, they say, hey, it's right there in 785.04 that you can pay compensatory damages, and that you don't have to rely on Frisch, you don't have to rely on any of these cases, although they're all supportive. The statute right on its face says that, and if you look at the notes of the Judicial Council and the reporter's notes, long-standing law in this state, they say, I haven't checked every single one of the cases, I assume you did, long-standing law in this state says compensatory damages are okay, even though the contempt is not continuing. They say we've missed the boat. That's what they say. We say we've struggled mightily on these cases and missed the issues.
I would I'm sorry.
Would you agree that that's what they seem to say?
That's what they seem to say, but I would absolutely disagree with the conclusion.
Okay, tell us why.
First, under the statute, the gateway, I don't know if that's the correct analogy, but the gate to the remedial sanctions is the definition of remedial sanction that's contained in 785.01 sub 3, which, as I noted and as the court is well aware, says that a remedial sanction means a sanction imposed for the purpose of terminating a continuing contempt of court. You don't get to the question of, well, which remedial sanction might I impose? That is, the trial court doesn't get to that issue until it gets through the definitional section of remedial sanction.
That means you can I don't mean you and I don't mean the Milwaukee County. Somebody can disobey a contempt, a order of the court for years and years and years, and then when the court says, well, I really mean business, they suddenly comply and they're home free for all those years. That can't be.
Well, the Judicial Council notes and both that are contained within the statutes annotated and the materials that are part of the record in the Wisconsin Law Library, as we pointed out in one of our briefs, point out that the purpose of the way the statute is set up is to give a clear choice to the trial court right at the outset, whether we're going down the remedial contempt avenue or the punitive contempt avenue. If the conduct is continuing, then it's a remedial contempt question. If the conduct is past, it's a question of punitive contempt. And so a party doesn't really have the option of ignoring the authority of the court and just complying on the eve of a court hearing, because if it in fact is past contempt, if the conduct is over, there is an entire separate section of the contempt statute that applies, and that's the punitive contempt.
The what?
The punitive contempt section.
And would they be, can the county be held liable under the punitive section?
Speaking generally, punitive contempt applies to past conduct. This has never been brought as a punitive contempt proceeding.
But you had to be in the presence of the court, no?
I don't believe that's part of the statute, no. That proceeding has never been brought.
What about immunity for the county? And punitive, would it be money, or would somebody go to jail? Under better conditions than here,
that's right.
That would be ironic, yes. All of those issues would have to be considered if and when a punitive contempt proceeding were brought. For instance, the memo sent by the Judicial Council to the Assembly at the time the bill was being considered states, if the contemptuous conduct has ended, no remedial sanction is possible. These penalties, meaning the remedial contempt penalties, and I see that I'm out of time, are indeterminate, i.e. their severity depends on how promptly the contemnor purges his or her contempt. And that is entirely consistent with the language of the statute that requires that the conduct be ongoing in order for a remedial contempt sanction to be awarded. I see I'm out of time, so I better stop and reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Patterson, Patrick Patterson, representing the plaintiffs, Mr. Christensen and others.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Patrick Patterson. I am cooperating counsel with the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee and the ACLU Foundation of Wisconsin, representing the plaintiff class in this case. The case is about accountability, and it's about the court's authority to hold the defendants here accountable for contempt of court. After 2.5 years of actually saving money by warehousing people for up to days at a time in squalid conditions in the booking area of the Milwaukee County Jail, in direct violation of the consent decree in this case, and denying and evading disclosure of those violations to the plaintiffs for approximately a year, the defendants were finally caught and brought before the court. By the time they finally admitted it, there were 16,000 plus violations that had occurred during a 2.5 year period. And I think the record is clear that the defendants have admitted that 16,000 plus figure, which was a question that came up before. The trial court set the figure at 16,662. Now, the record is clear that this was not just a matter of bureaucratic bungling or incompetence. The trial court found, and the Court of Appeals affirmed, that these violations were systematic, that they were intentional, they were carefully documented by officials in the jail. And when the evidence finally came out in September of 2004, we found that the county had documented them so carefully that these violations took up this much paper to just be recorded, 48 or 49 prisoners on a page. We found that there were lists documenting how many inmates had been held beyond 72 hours in the booking area and therefore were finally entitled to showers. There's a pre-printed form the county jail officials use saying the following inmates need to be showered as they have been in booking BKOW 72 hours. So this is not just that the county was not aware of what was going on.
But Mr. Patterson, they did correct in May.
Well, they finally, after a long period of time when the plaintiffs were inquiring about violations, after there had been hearings before the county board about problems in the booking area, after the county had continually advised the plaintiff there were no problems of this nature in the booking area and had refused to provide information, yes, then in September of 2004, they finally came into court and said, oh, yes, we do have this information. And then after several more months of discovery, then finally in May of 2004, they stopped the violations. They stopped the new violations. But that did nothing for the 16,000-some violations that occurred before and the people who had been held in these conditions before.
But if the remedial sanction means a sanction imposed for the purpose of terminating a continuing contempt, is there a continuing contempt after May 2004?
There absolutely is a continuing contempt. And I would like to direct the court's attention to the language of the statute. 785.01(3) does not say that the court may only order a compensatory sanction where there is continuing conduct that violates an order of a court. What it says is that a court may order a remedial sanction to terminate a continuing contempt of court. Now, that's a much broader concept. And if that statute said a sanction may be imposed for the purpose of terminating a current and ongoing conduct that violates a court order, then we'd have a very different case here. But we have a statute that says that the remedial sanction can be imposed for terminating a continuing contempt of court. And what this court has held, not just in the Frisch case, but in cases like Griffin, long before Frisch, the concept of contempt of court is much broader than just the conduct. It also encompasses the unremedied harm that occurs as a result of the contemptuous conduct. So, yes, they stopped committing new violations by May of 2004, but that did nothing for the conduct they had carried on for 2.5 years and damaged those 16,000-plus people.
And so when you say carried on for 2.5 years, the timing component comes to my mind. I have before me a copy of the settlement agreement, and for instance, on page 4 of the settlement agreement, it indicates in my copy, as of blank date of 2000, and it's not filled in, as of what time was there to be compliance?
The consent decree was, well, let me back up and tell you, I was not involved in the case at that point, so my knowledge comes from the record, as yours would. From my understanding of the record, the consent decree was approved in June of 2001 by the court, by the Circuit Court in Milwaukee County. And I've read transcripts that suggest that perhaps there was some sort of agreement among the parties and with the court that it might not go into effect until July 21st of 2001. What the evidence eventually showed about these violations is that they started at least by November of 2001. So there may have been a few months where there was compliance with the 30-hour rule, and
so
then that stopped.
So the timeline is the Circuit Court approved it in June of 2001.
Yes.
It's unclear whether or not it was – I don't want to misspeak. There's some evidence that it wasn't supposed to go into effect right away in June of 2001, but rather in July of 2001.
That's the latest date I've seen as a possible date for it going into effect.
Okay. And then
but the violations that we've got here were documented starting in November of 2001, which is clearly after any time the consent decree was to have gone into effect. And I don't think there's any dispute that you've heard from the defendants today or in the courts below that there were violations. They continued throughout this period, and the new violations didn't stop until May of 2004.
Let me ask you this. If they stopped in May 2004, why did you wait till the fall to file it?
There was a process of discovery going on. And in fact, the court was involved in these proceedings even earlier in trying to obtain discovery, get more detailed information about what was going on, and determine what to do about it. Back in November of 2003, there was a status conference with the court, in which the information the plaintiffs had gathered up to that time, which included an anonymous tip and included some information provided by a medical administrator, as well as some accounts from inmates, indicated that there were problems with this 30-hour rule. The plaintiffs were continually trying to get information from the county starting in the spring of 2003 about that. Finally, in November of 2003, they were before the court on it, so the court was actively involved by November of 2003. And at that point, the county agreed to begin providing some information. That information was provided, although very slowly over time, and then the parties were back before the court in April of 2004. And at that point, the court specifically said, if I can find my notes about it, that the court is making it clear that there is to be compliance with this agreement, speaking to the 30-hour rule. So in April of 2004, the court was saying that, in fact, the violations continued even after that. until approximately the beginning of May of 2004. So they continued for a number of weeks after that April 6th, 2004 hearing. So the court was involved over a period of time, but the violations continued over that period of time until the county finally started complying with the decree belatedly in May of 2004.
During the period from November 2001 to May 2004, would it be fair to say there were about 150,000 people who went through the jail?
Based on the county's estimates, that would be fair to say.
Okay, so, but you're talking about 16,662 who were not given timely booking. Is that right?
16,662 violations of the rule requiring that inmates be held no more than 30 hours in booking. Right.
And you know the names of those people?
We don't know all the names of those people. We know violations occurred, and they're listed as violations in what we have. The names can, my understanding is, the county can generate those names, and the county kept all the records of who those people were, and they have those.
Why are more than 130,000 people treated timely and 16,000 or so not treated timely? Was there something intentional with respect to the individuals among those 16,000?
I don't know of anything in the record that suggests that there was some intentional singling out of certain people for this mistreatment. So I can't answer the question of why these particular people became the victims of these violations, but they did.
Counsel, it seems to me that not only did the Court of Appeals rely on the holding in Frisch, but you and your clients, I should say, rely on the holding in Frisch to support their argument here today. Fair enough?
Well, we don't think the holding in Frisch is necessary to support our argument today, but we think it supports our position.
So you argue that it is the language of the statute which permits the compensatory damages for remedial contempt?
Absolutely, because the statute doesn't say conduct has to be continuing. It says the purpose of remedial sanction is to terminate a continuing contempt of court, and the court has recognized that the contempt continues.
And that language was interpreted and applied by this court in Frisch.
In Frisch and in Griffin and in other cases.
And in Frisch, the harm in that case was actually continuing. The contempt was actually continuing because the complainant was not able to seek a modification of her child support given her ex-husband Frisch's failure to comply with the court order. Fair enough?
The harm that was done to the complainant was that she didn't have the information she could have used to seek appropriate child support modification.
And so, therefore, the harm continued as a direct result of his failure to file timely the financial information.
Yes, that's true.
All right. And so do you rely at all on Frisch? I mean, assume we don't, for the sake of our conversation, that we don't go your way on the statutory language. Do you rely on Frisch to advance your client's argument?
I guess I have trouble distinguishing between Frisch and the statutory language because I think Frisch interprets the statutory language correctly. But I believe the court could reach the same result without Frisch because cases even before Frisch said the same thing.
Do you believe that Frisch applies the language correctly because the harmful condition that was to be remediated by the contempt order was ongoing?
Yes, we believe there was a there was an intentional violation of a court order, a clear and unambiguous language of a court order. It was done in a manner that frustrated the purpose of the order for a substantial period of time, and that's true in Frisch, and that's true in this case. And as a result, the victims of those violations have suffered foreseeable and avoidable injuries, which cannot be remedied. Just belatedly complying with the decree.
Use the past tense, had suffered, but in Frisch, she was actually suffering because she was unable to make her claim for a modification of child support.
But in this case, the 16,000-plus violations are of people who are suffering because they've never received a remedy for what was done to them.
I assume the former Mrs. Frisch was a person, too. But
Let the record reflect.
I don't understand the distinction that you're trying to make.
The harm in Frisch was remedied by the circuit court by a $100,000 compensatory award. The harm in this case could be remedied by a compensatory award by the circuit court in this case to the victims of the violation. So I think they're the same situation.
Even though I think you're conceding that the harmful condition itself ceased. Everyone's been talking about May of 2004, and it's in the brief. That harmful condition has ceased.
No, I would not concede that the harmful condition ceased.
Okay, tell me how. Why not?
The county stopped committing new violations. It didn't create any new victims, but it did nothing to remedy what had been done to the 16,000 people before they started complying with the court's order.
So if that analysis was adopted, when would there ever be a contempt of court that could be called remedial? It would always be ongoing.
Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that there always will be a compensatory remedy that will take care of the ongoing harm. There are cases where there may not be that kind of remedy. And in this case, in fact, on remand, the trial court may well decide that for some people there are not compensable injuries, whereas for other people there are. The trial court may determine under the remand directed by the Court of Appeals, the trial court may determine that, for example, people who are held only 1 hour beyond the 30-hour rule may be only entitled to nominal damages or minimal damages. Whereas people who are held 4 or 5 days are entitled to much more substantial damages. There can be a lot of different gradations and different decisions made about whether there actually are going to be damages for each violation.
But it would always be remedial.
It would be remedial, yes.
Even though the harmful condition is ended.
Well, again, I find it hard.
The harmful condition, which served as the basis of the complaint, has ended.
The new violations of the court order ended.
Fair enough.
I would have to say.
Counsel, when I read Frisch, I read a timeliness component to it. I look at paragraph 4, which has a holding and a comparable holding towards the end of the opinion. But it says, in reading paragraph 4, in the middle of paragraph 4, the timely provision of information was an essential part of the court's order. Because Ronald could not and did not turn back time when he produced the required information too late to be acted on, his contempt was and is continuing within the legislative directive of WSSTATS 767-2M. And continuing on in the opinion, I see in paragraph 47, it states in part, although Ronald did produce the documents, continuing on, producing documents was only part of the court's order. Producing documents in italics on time for all of the years in which child support was due was an equal part of the order. Failure to, italics, timely produce income information as required was really the essence of Ronald's contempt because it shielded him from the exposure to regular contemporary court-ordered modifications of child support. And I won't repeat, but towards the concluding paragraph, is similar to the introductory paragraph, that paragraph, I look at paragraph 81, his failure to produce the information in a timely manner as required. The timely provision of information was an essential element of the court's order because he can't turn back the clock and make it timely now. He's within the legislative directive. What component does timeliness play in your analysis?
I think the same principle applies to this case. Timely compliance with the court's order, with the consent decree in this case, was an essential part of that order. So where the county did not timely comply by limiting people being held in booking to 30 hours or less, those people were damaged. And the fact that the county started complying much later as to other people did nothing for the part of the class that was damaged before. And I think we have to keep in mind this was, as the court pointed out earlier, brought as a class action. So the party, in a sense, in this case, is the entire class. So we have some people in the class who have been treated properly under the consent decree since May of 2004, but we have a lot of people who were treated improperly before May 2004, and they're parties too. And the county's belated compliance, just as in the case with Frisch, came too late to do anything for that part of the plaintiff class.
Counselor,
and they're still without a remedy.
How is your action any different than action for personal injury for these folks that were kept in booking longer than 30 days? How does it differ?
It's different in the sense that the duty should be much clearer here. We have a specific court order that specifies what was supposed to be done. That created a duty. The county breached that duty. We're trying to determine a remedy for that duty using the contempt process. Now, in fact, a big difference would be that the trial court is going to have much more discretion as to what the shape of that remedy is than it would in a personal injury case, I believe, because of the court's broad inherent powers and authority under contempt. It can shape a remedy which could be much more creative and has to take into account other factors. For example, the trial court, if it's determining a remedy for contempt and determines that remedial sanctions are appropriate, as we think it should in this case, has to consider that the remedial sanction must serve remedial ends, it must be related to the nature of the contempt, and it must take into account the defendant's ability to pay.
Also, if you look at the statute, though, you're going to have to prove, before you can get any monetary damages, a sum of money sufficient to compensate the party for the injury suffered. To me, that just sounds like a personal injury claim, the way you're going about it.
I think the court has a broad discretion about how it can treat that. It could look at it as a whole set of personal injury claims. It could look at it in terms of, well, how much money did the county save by not complying with this decree over the period of years? And maybe that's an appropriate measure of damages that would compensate the plaintiff class. What could be done to improve the processes and the facilities at the jail that would prevent these kinds of events from happening in the future? That might be an appropriate compensatory remedy. So I think the court has much broader discretion in this kind of contempt proceeding than it would have in a personal injury case, and I think that is a significant difference.
Mr. Patterson, let's assume for a minute that you don't win on your contempt argument. What is your argument in regard to a claim breach of contract? Could you explain that to me?
Yes, Your Honor. The case, as you've indicated, was pursued under both contempt and breach of contract claims in the trial court. And that's because a consent decree like this is both a court order and a contract. So in addition to the court's power to enforce the decree through contempt, we also believe it has the authority to treat it as a breach of contract case. And in fact, the trial court found there was a breach of contract, which I think is clear and basically undisputed that the contract was violated. So the question is then, what are the consequences of that? And the traditional remedy for a breach of contract is damages. It's the damages that would put the wronged party in the position he or she would have held before the breach of contract. So we believe that under straight application of basic contract principles, there is a contract claim here, and damages is an appropriate remedy.
But, counsel, this is not just a contract. This settlement agreement was ultimately approved by the trial court and became part of a court order.
Correct.
And as I understand it, and I can't say I've checked every single case because I haven't, it seems to me that the federal cases generally say once you've got a order of the court, even though it's a settlement agreement, the breach of contract issue is no longer with us, and we are under a court order. You don't get damages for breach of contract.
Well, I don't read the cases that way, Your Honor. I think they provide that either a contract theory or a contempt theory could be pursued, and damages could be awarded under either. The damages may be similar under either. You can't award duplicate damages, but the damages could be awarded under either theory. And even under a contract theory, in a situation like this where we're dealing with a consent decree, the damages component can take on an equitable nature. I think that's what the Cook versus City of Chicago case says that the defendant cited.
I wanted to go back to Frisch. Frisch and many of the cases that are cited in the briefs are all family law cases. Can you distinguish all of those cases and say this isn't a family law case, so none of them applies?
I don't believe you can. I think the principles are the same, as I've said before. I know that these kinds of issues have often come up in family law cases, and they haven't come up in the past, to my knowledge, in cases identical to this. I'm not really aware of any cases identical to this.
Your opponent says that we ought to look at Frisch again and either cabin it to family law cases or rethink the whole thing because they think that Justice Butler's dissent, joined by Justice Bradley, has unintended consequences, and today is one of them.
Well, I'm loath.
It imposed thousands of dollars on Milwaukee County when it doesn't have the money to pay it after it has corrected the problem.
Well, as I said, Your Honor, one of the factors that the court is mandated to take into account in awarding remedial sanctions is the defendant's ability to pay. So I know the county keeps raising this issue of catastrophic financial consequences, but we've never gotten to that point in the trial court, and if and when we do get to that point, the court has been directed to take into consideration the county's financial condition. So I think we can trust the trial court to do that.
The other issue is, do you think the Court of Appeals erred in taking away the trial court discretion? They just said order damages. Be the better if you agree at all with the Court of Appeals, which is a question for this court. Maybe the better approach is send it back to the trial court to consider whether compensatory damages are in order.
Well, what the Court of Appeals directed the trial court to do was, quote, to determine in light of this decision and Wisconsin Statute 785.04 the sum of money sufficient to compensate the inmates held in violation of the consent decree for the loss or injuries suffered and such further proceedings consistent with this opinion as may be appropriate. We don't read that as requiring the trial court to award a set amount of money or any money to 16,000 different people. As I said before, I think the trial court retains broad discretion under this remand to figure out what sum of money would be sufficient to compensate the class. And there are various ways the court could do that.
Including none?
Including for some people, possibly none. If they were held at half an hour beyond the 30 hours, perhaps.
What, has to look at every single one of the 16,662?
That's not the only way to do it. A court can do that if it chooses to do it that way. But class action remedies in the federal system certainly have found different ways to determine class remedies. And by looking at the class as a whole and figuring out what would compensate the class as a whole, and that kind of thing could be done here.
Counselor, do you agree with opposing counsel that the class certification itself has to be reexamined at the trial court level because there was never a request for damages, but simply for injunctive relief?
I don't think that requires a reconsideration of the class certification. It is correct that the class certification was for an injunctive action, and that's what the plaintiff sought, and that's what they got. But we're at a different stage now because they got an injunction that they expected to be followed and enforced, and we now have an injunction that wasn't followed. So the question is, what do we do about that? And that's not controlled by what kind of pleadings went into the original action which led to the injunction. And that's controlled by what's the court's authority to deal with the situation where the injunction has been violated. That's an entirely different question.
There are different opportunities for members of a class, and I think different notice proceedings, although I haven't looked at it for a while, when you're suing someone for money damages in regard to folks that will be members of the class, that it's my understanding we're not complied with in this case.
That's correct, because there wasn't a need to notify each individual potential class member and give them an opportunity to opt out, because there were not damages being sought for them individually. If the court elects to deal with this case as that kind of class action on remand, then it may very well decide it has to do something like that, to give that kind of notice, if that's the remedy we're looking at now. But as I said before, that may not be the remedy that we're looking at now, depending on how the trial court decides to handle it.
Could I ask a technical question? The people for whom you were seeking damages are 16,000 some people between 2001 and 2004?
There were 16,000 plus violations in that period. We're not sure that that's the same number of people. It's possible that some people went through this two or three times, but there were 16,000 plus violations.
For example, this is the Milton Christensen case. Is Milton Christensen eligible?
As far as I understand the record, he would not be eligible because he was not in the booking area during that period. He was the original inmate who filed a pro se handwritten petition back in 1996, on which Legal Aid Society was later appointed to represent the plaintiffs, and it then became a class action.
Do you rely on the concept of the inherent power of the court in contempt?
Your Honor, we think it's important to recognize the inherent power of the court and to recognize that the court has that power and is not a mere debating society, and that Chapter 785 was enacted against the backdrop of that power and should be interpreted in light of that power, that inherent power. If the court were to decide that Chapter 785 does not allow a compensatory remedy, then we would argue that the inherent power of the court does give it that authority. But we don't think the court has to go that far, because we think Chapter 785 does it.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson.
Thank you.
Mr. Jones.
Thank you. Just to respond to a couple of the points made by Mr. Patterson. The first point he raised was this issue of whether the statute's talking about continuing conduct or continuing contempt, and whether continuing contempt is a broader concept. And I think what I would point the court to we certainly cited any number of cases in our brief that talk about and stand for the proposition that remedial contempt is a means to stop ongoing contemptuous conduct and to affect present and future compliance with a court order. That's the King case, the Evans v. Lupke case, the Benn case, the Schroeder case, Upper Lakes Shipping. In addition, the Judicial Council note to 785.01 says, and I quote, "Traditionally, the purpose of the sanction was remedial in that it was designed to force a person into complying with an order of the court and terminating a continuing contempt of court."
Counsel, if I may, with regard to the Judicial Council notes, when I looked at the amicus brief of Martineau and Gordy Mize, it caused me pause, because when I was first studying contempt in this state, you know, Martineau had written the Law Review article. Martineau was the guiding light on the law of contempt in this state. He was the reporter. He wrote those notes that you're talking about. And Gordon Mize was probably the prime teacher of what this statute meant. And now we have both of them on a brief saying, hey, you know, we created this. We created all the notes. This is our creation, and this is what it means. How do you get around their argument? Then, after setting that up, they then look at the statute and say, plain meaning, look at 785.04 sub 1A.
Well, I think in the first instance, there certainly is a doctrine that after-the-fact statements by drafters of statutes or those involved in the drafting of statutes are not necessarily admissible as legislative history.
Sure.
And the second thing I would point out is that even in his article, which was written, I think, a year or two, this is Mr. Martineau, Professor Martineau, a year or two after the statute was enacted, he recognized, and I believe this is on pages 701 and 702 of his article, he recognized that there was a potential problem in the statute, and that on the face of the statute, the language of the statute indicates that compensatory damages and other remedial contempt sanctions are not available when the conduct has ceased, that is, for past conduct. And his suggestion or a footnote on that issue said, well, that's an issue for the legislature to correct, and there could be a way for the legislature to correct that. So even in 1981, as a drafter of the statute, he recognized that the language does not on its face speak to granting remedial contempt sanctions under these circumstances. And if you go back to the actual underlying materials, as we pointed out to the court, those materials point to the idea that if the contemptuous conduct has ended, no remedial sanction is possible. That was in the very document that went to the assembly as an explanation of the statute. So I think the statute does speak to continuing conduct, not just this broader concept of continuing contempt that Mr. Patterson spoke of. And what the Court of Appeals decision here does, in addition to departing from the plain language of the statute, is it does depart from this court's holding in Frisch. It expands the holding in Frisch in the sense
Counsel,
that...
Counsel, excuse me. In your latter part of your response to Justice Bradley's question, you made reference to some notes that accompanied the legislation to the floor. Were you talking about the drafting committee comments?
I was talking about, with a particular language I was quoting, an analysis of the draft assembly bill sent to the assembly committee.
I haven't heard anyone talk about the drafting committee comments for the statute. And specifically that portion of the comments which states, quote, the definition makes it clear that a remedial sanction is appropriate only when the contempt is continuing and cannot be imposed if for any reason the contempt has ceased. And then it goes on, even as a result of the settlement of the case, unquote. I wonder how that fits into your argument.
Well, I think it's entirely consistent with their argument that the statute, the remedial sanction portion of the statute, was intended to stop ongoing contemptuous conduct, and that those remedial sanctions are only available when, in fact, there is an ongoing.
Are you aware of any legislative notes or drafting committee notes which would be inconsistent with such an interpretation?
The legislative history that I found, and I guess in the broader sense, really the Judicial Council materials, the legislative history that I found is attached to the brief we submitted in response to Professor Martineau's brief, and I believe that those materials stand for the proposition that the conduct has to be continuing in order for remedial contempt to apply. I see the red light is on, so I would rely on our briefs for the remainder of my arguments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Thank you, Mr. Jones, and thank you, Mr. Patterson, for our second case in as many years relating to remedial contempt. And the case will, of course, be taken under advisement. That ends our hearing on 06-AP-803, Christensen versus Sullivan. And that ends our